Hey guys, co-host for CMN. We were really happy with how this bonus episode turned out, and rather than letting it sit behind the Patreon wall, we're giving it out as a late holiday gift to you. If you haven't joined the Patreon, if you've never listened to Chaos Magic News at all, this can be your jumping on point. And if you're a longtime listener and you'd like to see us do more of these sort of reading commentaries, let us know and give us some suggestions for what you'd want us to read in the future. All of that said, we hope you enjoy.
Oh, you know? Okay.
And it was like, eh, that's kind of,
I guess it's erotic.
It's like, yeah.
Very English is all I'm going to say.
Very English.
The first aeon, I was the Great Spirit. In the second aeon, men knew me as the Horned God, Pangenitor, Panphage. In the third aeon, I was the Dark One, the Devil. In the fourth aeon, men knew me not, for I am the Hidden One. In the fifth aeon, I appear before you as Baphomet, the god before all gods who shall endure to the end of the earth. In this new aeon, I appear to you as C.M.N.
Imagine that there is a brilliant white light just above.
It's commentary on the magic art.
In the year of the primal force, in the dawn of terrestrial birth.
Oh, that was very educational.
Now magic will take place. Don't be fooled by what I just said.
So welcome, welcome everyone. I am Sham Miracles Kennedy, and this is Chaos Magic News.
Patreon bonus.
Oh, wait. Yeah, that's right. That you have to say the hey, howdy ho, patronauts, or whatever the awful thing that we have to say now because it's the law.
Howdy, hey, patronauts. How are you doing? My, you look lovely today. Is that a $5 bill in your pocket, or are you just happy to see me?
So, taking a break from the iceberg, we decided we're going to do a little bit of a reading series. I'm not sure if we're going to work our way all the way through any bit of literature, but we've definitely got a couple choice things we're going to talk about.
Well, I've never finished a book in my life, and I don't intend to start now.
I usually get full about halfway through.
I hear if you dip them in water as you're eating.
So today we're going to read a chapter, a letter. I don't know what you'd really call it. It says letter, so let's go with letter. We're going to read a letter from Aleister Crowley's penultimate work, Magic Without Tears.
Doesn't penultimate mean the second to last?
Yeah, I think it was his like second to last work. It might be his final one. I know it was published posthumously.
I wanted to make sure that you weren't using words to sound more photosynthesis. It's like they're going to call you on that.
I could be very much wrong. I don't remember the last thing that Crowley wrote.
The point is, you're using that word in the right context. You just might be mistaken about this thing's placement. It doesn't matter.
Right.
The point is, this is the first chapter, whatever you call it, for Magic Without Tears, where Crowley answers a letter that actually gives a laid out definition for magic. And I know what you're thinking. Well, he already said magic is the art and science of change in conformity with will. And while that's in there, he actually goes into quite a more fleshed out breakdown of what is magic. And we're going to read through it, and we're going to give a little bit of commentary.
Some brief background. Magic Without Tears is by the infamous Aleister Crowley, somebody that we're quite familiar with on this show, obviously. It's written as a series of letters between a couple of different students and himself, and edited into a sort of instruction of what magic is, his various ideas on it, and how to do it. I would say it's almost a more, if Liber ABBA is like the magic for dummies kind of book, this is like the advice column version of how to do magic. Not to denigrate or say it's bad, obviously, but I just mean that it's a lot more of conversational and directed towards trying to like explain things to somebody as opposed to like a more technical kind of manual, if that makes sense.
And also representing somewhat of an evolution in Crowley's thinking over time, because Liber Abba to this is actually a pretty good gap, right?
Yeah, number of years.
Yeah. Either way, the first chapter itself is it's a very interesting one, because what is magic? You know, if somebody asked you what is magic, how would you define it to them? Crowley, being a smart guy, he's already a long-winded and very pretentious series of answers, using words like postulate and continuous phenomena. And what's another one that's got a bunch of syllables?
Euclidean.
Yeah, there you go. Isn't that when you only got one eye?
No, that's when you pee yourself. All right. Okay. We good to go?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, we're so painfully unfunny.
Parasaur, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. What is magic? Why should anyone study and practice it? Very natural. The obvious preliminary question of any subject soever. We must certainly get all this crystal clear. Fear not that I shall fail to set forth the whole business as concisely as possible, yet as fully, as cogently, yet as lucidly as may prove within my power to do. At least I need not waste any time on telling you what magic is not, or to go into the story of how the word came to be misapplied to conjuring tricks and to sham miracles such as are to this day foisted by charlatan swindlers, either within or without the Roman communion, upon a gaping crew of pious imbeciles. First, let me go all Euclidean and rub your nose in the definition, postulate, and theorems given in my comprehensive, but alas, too advanced and too technical treatise on the subject.
Okay. Right off the bat, this is what I talk about with pretentious.
God.
He openly admits that it's this is far too advanced and technical. He's like, I am going to give you, basically, he just said, I'm going to give you a bunch of stuff that you don't really need. What he's telling you is what he's saying is, calm down. I'm going to hit you with the TLDR right at the end.
I love Crowley's writing. He's just such an asshole. It's so beautiful.
I will say that a lot of people act like the way Crowley writes is impenetrable. Like, you can't understand. It's like, you understand exactly what he's saying. He just sounds like somebody.
He sounds like he's telling you this while you're holding the piss bucket.
But he definitely has the air of somebody. He's like, oh, somebody wrote this letter to me asking this question. Well, it's like, yeah, well, you came to the right place. Anyway, well, we could go on about his writing style, which, like I said, it's Crowley. It's how he writes. So, you know what you're in for the most part. But the actual definition, I'll take this one. One, definition: magic is the science and art of causing change to occur in conformity with will. There's something weird about science and art, not art and science. It feels very tock-tick, not tick-tock. But okay, there's more to this, though, where it says, illustration. It is my will to inform the world of certain facts within my knowledge. Therefore, I take, quote, magical weapons, pen, ink, and paper. I write, quote, incantations, these sentences, in the, quote, magical language, i.e. that which is understood by people I wish to instruct. I call forth, quote, spirits, such as printers, publishers, booksellers, and so forth, and constrain them to convey my message to those people. The composition and distribution is thus an act of magic, by which I cause changes to take place in conformity with my will. We've approached this on the show. I'm sure other people have talked about it. It's when you have a definition of magic, the art and science change in conformity with will, anything, if it is a conscious will desire and you do it, is an act of magic. So, you know, me talking, it's my will to inform the people. So I conjure the spirit of clean feed and the recordings and editing software of Ableton Live, and I make use of the etheric realms of the internet to put my stuff online. You know, that's the, you can, and he's being a little tongue in cheek. You know, it is the idea of, I have a desire, so I get the right implements, I perform the right actions to make these things happen. But this is really where he starts, where he's talking about it. It's too technical and too...
It's the sort of thing that you lose your head over if you don't pay attention to it, or you don't, if you're not prepared for it. The person they're writing to seems to at least have, you know, based on the comments earlier about saying, well, at least I don't have to tell you what it's not, you know, all those charlatans and hucksters and stuff, has a certain head on their shoulders about what magic is or isn't.
Crowley's like, look, I'm not, I know right off the bat, I don't have to say, like, don't ask me how to throw a fireball or nothing.
Yeah,
right?
Don't ask me how to levitate.
Yeah, but at the same time, this definition is, it's still something that people deal with today where they go, any intentional act of will is a magical act. And it's like, you can frame it like that, but when you do that, you make it more difficult to talk about the spooky woo woo,
right?
The stuff that we refer the acts, the collection of practices that we all collectively agree as supernatural or beyond conventional understandings of science.
Well, see, that's sort of the chaos magic problem too, because, you know, most chaos would not agree with that definition in the slightest. They would be like, I don't have to believe any particular interpretation of these sorts of things. I could say that it's entirely me using perfectly mundane and scientifically backed, quote unquote, ways of messing with my own brain or whatever, you know, psych model people, and getting results. And it doesn't matter if it's actually supernatural or out of the grasp of regular science.
Yeah, you're right. Even right off the rip there, the definition I'm trying to get to is, but...
Well, I think you had it. You just took a step too far with it. I think that we have a set of practices we all collectively agree are magic. It's not a cross-cultural one. It's not a atemporal one. It's a modern historical one. But we all know, in that sort of bullshit, I know it when I see it kind of way, that when somebody's waving,
that's what I was going to get at,
waving around a wand or doing a chant or sitting there chanting a mantra, all of these sorts of practices that we have various cultural, historical, or other social relations to, that we classify as magic. It's not an absurd thing to say that. We all kind of have a grasp of it. And again, it's not a hard scientific line, but it's definitely one, for the purposes of having conversations about it, keeps us from being stuck over here in the hyperbolic world of Aleister Crowley, where he's telling you that I'm writing a book and I summoned a publisher.
Well, at least Crowley is, you know, you can tell he is being
He's being hyperbolic. He's demonstrating a concept and an idea. Crowley would also tell you that, you know, you can summon an angel by chanting Enochian.
Yeah, but, and then there are the, if we're talking about the idea of how do you have practical conversations about magic as a practice, or magic as a collection of practices, this is one that is actually difficult, depending on who you're talking to, because there are people that will say things like, you don't do magic, you are magic, or any act of, you know, anything you do is magic if it's conscious and willed. And it's like, well, I understand what you're trying to drive at. If there's the notions of, there's no difference between the sacred and the profane, the magical and the mundane, it's all one unified thing. So it's just as magical to get up and walk across the room as it is to float across it, astral project yourself out of the room or whatever. It is, I feel sometimes that is a shallow axiom that gets repeated that doesn't contribute anything to the conversation. Sometimes it's just something somebody says. It's almost a non-answer, right? It doesn't push forward the conversation in any real way. Especially if somebody's asking, like, what is magic and why should I do it? Or, like, what is magic and how do you do it?
Yeah.
You know, if you say, hey, I'm trying to get into magic, and then somebody's like, oh, well, everything you do is magic. And it's like, well, shit, okay. Well, like, great. That doesn't help me at all.
Right. But to continue with Crowley here, I think we'll get a grasp of why Crowley is trying to set this idea up for you in the process of explaining what magic is and how to do it, rather than being taken as a completely literal thing here.
Well, I would say that he introduces this, and then he follows it with, like, you know, two pages of follow-up explaining the nuance of what he just said. That's the point of giving the definition, postulate, theorem. And then, like I said, he does give you the too long didn't read at the end. But if you're, you know, if that's where he left the conversation and said that was the answer, you might as well just pitch this book into the ground, throw it in the bin.
Yeah.
All right. Postulate. Any required change may be affected by application of the proper kind and degree of force in the proper manner through the proper medium to the proper object. Illustration. I wish to prepare an ounce of chloride of gold. I must take the right kind of acid, nitro, hydrochloric, and no other, in sufficient quantity and of adequate strength, and place it in a vessel which will not break, leak, or corrode, in such a manner as will produce undesirable results, with the necessary quantity of gold, and so forth. Every change has its own conditions. In the present state of our knowledge and power, some changes are not possible in practice. We cannot cause eclipses, for instance, or transform lead into tin, or create men from mushrooms. But it is theoretically possible to cause in any object any change of which that object is capable by its nature, and the conditions are covered by the above postulate. Like, already getting into the nuance. If you want certain changes to happen, there are required conditions, and it is by understanding like what needs to be done to cause this change that defines what your actions are going to be. And he gives a semi-scientific one, and then he goes, there is an extent by which certain things cannot change in a practical sense, but that's not important. If we go into the idea that if the change is possible in some instance, then theoretically it is possible to happen. And that's already sort of opening the door for like the ineffable, the unexplainable, the subtle. And then also in a backhanded way, it's almost sort of like, well, yeah, I mean, like theoretically you could do a lot of stuff, but like what's likely to happen, what's theoretically possible versus what's practically possible.
What's the phrase he uses? I liked it a lot.
Create men from mushrooms.
Yes.
That's really cool. I like that idea. You should do that.
The ending there, but it is theoretically possible to cause in any object any change of which that object is capable by nature. There's sort of an implication here that's lost in a lot of modern chaos magic in particular.
Change capable by nature is what you're
right,
saying.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And that I was going to say, there's a very hard and essential nature that Crowley's trying to put on things here. We can't cause eclipses because it's not in our nature or their nature to be affected by the sorts of things we can do.
Well, no, what I think he's actually saying is, as it stands right now, those things are not doable in a practical sense. But he says, theoretically, if it's within the nature of this thing that it could happen, if the potentiality is there, we could. So I think what he's saying is that you definitely can make men from mushrooms if you get good scrub. What he's saying is right now, listen, he's like, listen, I'm shitting in an outhouse. All right. Running water came out yesterday. There's some guy that's talking to me about magnets on a fridge, and I don't own a fridge, you know? So I don't have it in me to be making lead from tin or turning tin into lead or vice versa. They just came out with the letter W, and I think that's really highfalutin. I'm not about it. When did Crowley live? It's like 1500s,
right?
This
isn't a year that you're describing. This is like a fever dream. Like you know how there's like a clock in Julius Caesar, and that's like a big anachronism, right? Like this is like an entire play of just that, like of just things that don't belong where they are.
Just Aleister Crowley, just a little woozy because he had to take his heroin, and he's forgotten what time he's in. Running water, elitist.
The point I was trying to make is I think Crowley's playing really tight with this definition in a way, because you're right. It is playing to the idea of, oh, if it's possible, it's possible. If it's within the nature of this thing, but he's also kind of backing down a little bit and saying like, well, you know, there's certain things that you're never going to be able to do because it's not there.
If it ain't in the nature of the thing, if within nature it is not possible, it just isn't possible.
Right.
That's what he's saying.
That's the big turning point between this kind of thought and like modern Coyote thought. There's a certain strain of chaos magic thought that would tell you that, like, oh, well, there's no like essential nature to reality or anything. Everything's just paradigms and how you look at it. Everything's possible as long as you figure out a way to set your will to it.
Well, I think you're being a little more generous. I think that there's a certain line of bad Coyote thinking.
Right.
Not you listeners. You guys are great. You're thoughtful. You are the child of scientific illuminism. And your forays into the inscrutable are as grounded and concrete as anyone could ask for in such murky territories of waving a wand around to get a big titty goth girlfriend. And we love you for it. But there are certain bad coyotes, like bad people. Could you imagine, right? If there are people that are bad at magic, but still walk around like they're good at magic. But there's a certain strain of these people that are, you know, these are the anything goes people. Anything you can do is magic, and it's always going to work. It's all magic is purely about like your intent and your desire to do it. Blah, blah, blah. Those people that, you know, that's the folks that I'm going to turn around and be king of the moon by next Wednesday because I got that Burger King collectible mug and I put it and look, it's got the guy from Peaky Blinders on it. And I poured the Baja Blast into it while I said the William Burroughs, Brian Geisen cut up technique thing that I made by
cutting up my pink slip.
By cutting up my birth certificate. So obviously, you know, I'm going to be a big deal.
All right. That's a good place to segue into because now we're talking about intentionality, which is right where Crowley's about to go. Theorems. One, every intentional act is a magical act. And in the version that I have, it has this footnote. By intentional, I mean willed. But even unintentional acts, so seeming, are not truly so. Thus, breathing is an act of the will to live. And developing a disease may be an act of the will to die.
I am actually a big fan of that, and I'm glad you have this version. Because we've talked about this in the early episodes of the notions of the unconscious drives that might manifest in your life. And I do try to hold on to this idea of you didn't do it on purpose, it wasn't magic. But I do think that there is something to these ideas of that unconscious saboteur or something like that, that there are some times where you might not have been consciously willing something, but like it's what you wanted to happen. And Crowley offers a very good example of breathing is the body's, that deep sub-animal, I suppose, that down to the core of a biological organism that you are a part of or is a part of you or you and it is, there's really no distinction. You're one holistic thing, but deep down on that core, there is always the cells and your nervous system, all of the thinky and non-thinky bits that have a drive to keep going. Even when you're sitting there saying, man, I want to fucking die. Everything sucks. It's terrible. Your blood keeps pumping. I think maybe that's a good way you could go about exploring certain ideas, even on a more fringe, spooky woo-woo of like, well, why the hell that happened? You can analyze that idea of like your will. There is a will that is not the same. It's actually, that's a good question. Is it the same will? But, you know, at the very least, there's the will that you apprehend as your conscious directed will, and there's the will that goes on whether you're paying attention to it or not. And that's a really interesting thought.
This is Crowley, so, you know, to let the secret out, Crowley has a completely different conception of will because Crowley has the idea of true will.
Right.
And this has variously been described by lots of different people in varying different ways. But big thing about it is that we can all agree that true will is this transcendent sort of thing that connects you to the holy guardian angel or whatever metaphysical bugaboo you want to call it. It is something that is entirely beyond the normal mundane conceptions of will. So it's, we could obviously assume that all of these other, this will to live, this will to die, which, you know, that could be Thanatos, Eros type ideas on top of, you know, psychological type things, which
Crowley was also, yeah,
he's
a fan
got
of.
His bag on psychology, yeah, as well, but we'll go into a completely different area if we have that conversation. The point being is that I think for Crowley, all of this is subsumed in this, again, this metaphysical transcendent will.
Yeah, this all-encompassing will that is there from before birth, after death, and the many variations of death and rebirth, right? You know, that thing that the formula of death, resurrection, and rebirth, that sort of thing. There's the V's on either end of the thing.
Oh, right. Remains. Yeah. His reinterpretation of the EIO formula. That's something we could talk about at some point, too. Exactly. That'd be cool. Let's cut through the rest of this then. Every successful act has conformed to the postulate. Every failure proves that one or more requirements of the postulate have not been fulfilled. Illustrations. There may be a failure to understand the case, as when a doctor makes a wrong diagnosis and his treatment injures his patient. There may be a failure to apply the right kind of force, as when a rustic tries to blow out an electric light. There may be failure to apply the right degree of force, as when a wrestler has his hold broken. There may be failure to apply the force in the right manner, as when one presents a check at the wrong window of the bank. There may be failure to employ the correct medium, as when Leonardo da Vinci found his masterpiece fade away. The force may be applied to an unsuitable object, as when one tries to crack a stone, thinking it a nut.
Okay, and these are all very
amusing, very funny, very dry English humor.
But I do like the idea of like, well, if it didn't work. Well, obviously, it didn't conform to the postulate. How do you know? Because if it had conformed to the postulate,
it would have worked.
It would have worked. But he does give some notions. And there are definitely ways you could apply those in a magical sense. And at the same time, with the idea of every act is a magical act, that sort of thing. The force in the wrong place, the wrong kind of force. Force on the wrong object. Those are easily applicable to mundane actions that he's showing, but you can take a step back and think of them in terms of bigger picture things, you know, bigger, you know, more things that require a more subtle understanding of things.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think a big thing to take away from just that whole statement right there is a lot of times when you do magic and it doesn't work, you should probably rethink what you did, because I feel like lots of people, when the magic doesn't work, they just go, oh, well, I guess that I'm not getting that magically.
Well, and then it also turns into the ideas of magic follows the path of least resistance. If you've ever heard that one, there's a really easy one, money, right? Everybody talks about like money magic, and it's like, if money magic, it's like, well, if you're doing a spell to like, man, I really want a bank, like a truck carrying like a bank deposit to just like drop a bag in front of me. It's like, that is an example of force in the wrong area, or for, you know, trying to overcome something, make something very unlikely happen, or acting in a way where the subtle sort of influence that you can employ is very unlikely to be the right amount of force or the right kind of force. The position you would have to be in where that is a thing that could even be in the realm of possibility is so far out of left field that it's just, you might as well have just wished for it or pissed in the wind. The reasonable ways on which this can happen, where it's like, I want to raise my job, or I want to pick up some overtime, or man, I need to sell this or try to get more customers to my business. These are examples of where the force might be applied in ways that they could be effective.
Right.
Rather than like, man, it would be really great if I had a rich uncle who just died.
I like the Da Vinci one too, because I think that's something that probably gets forgotten about a little bit more in magic. You know, sometimes you're just trying to go about something entirely the wrong way. I see that with sigils a lot, I think. Like, maybe it worked well for other people. As far as I've seen and other people have explained to me, like, when you do sigils for, like, long-term goals or, like, personal, like, mental, psychological, or otherwise, like, you know, self-improvement sort of things, they tend to not work. Probably because you're constantly thinking about them. They're sorts of things that are attached to your sense of identity and therefore are always sort of on your mind. Maybe that sort of thing. And that's what I think Crowley is talking about with this, the Leonardo's da Vinci's masterpieces fading. It's just not the right, it's not the right medium. It's not the right format.
It's not something that is going to literally here. It's something that it's not going to hold.
Right. Yeah. That's if your goal is something like that, that's why I like daily ritual type things. Hell, fucking positive affirmation type bullshit is even more effective for this sort of thing. At least what I've seen.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm not 100% if I would agree, because that can be a little anecdotal, but definitely.
Oh, magic is anecdotal. I'm sorry.
But no, I'm sure there are people that would argue. It's like, oh, no. My sigils work just fine. There are the types of things that, like, trying to do a sigil for something that is going to either be an ongoing problem or something that is going to take a long time to really get through. Those can, and then you fire it off and then just leave it alone. It is almost the problem of a one-time act to try to change the forecast of a very long-term thing. For me, I would say that would confer with my experience too. It's like, if you're trying to make a single thing happen where it's like, I need this one incident to go my way, you know, I need to find this thing, or I need this person to give me this, or I need this van to smack into a wall and drop its bank deposit so I can, you know, that's something that's more likely to be effective if the idea is like, I'm going to do a sigil for it and just throw it out there, rather than like, I need this bank van to screw up multiple times and drop multiple sacks over a period of 6 months. Because God damn, I spent all that Patreon money way too fast.
Okay. The first requisite for causing any change is thorough qualitative and quantitative understanding of the condition. Illustration: the most common cause of failure in the life is ignorance of one's own true will, or of the means by which to fulfill that will. A man may fancy himself a painter and waste his life trying to become one, or he may be really a painter and yet fail to understand and to measure the difficulties peculiar to that career. So now we're already back on the true will conversation that we should have saved it for there, shouldn't we have?
Yeah, I think the second one coming after this also kind of suffers where we've touched on it a little bit, but this is an example of the common failure is misunderstanding your true will. And then he says, or of the means by which to fulfill that will. This is kind of what we're talking about, where it's if even on a simple level, if your will is to get money and your solution is like, I really want some money to just fall out of the sky, you're misunderstanding the conditions.
That's not how you get money, sir.
That's just not how it happens. Most, you know, 99.999% of the time.
Yeah, you know, if your true will is to get really lucky, focus on that.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's the thing. If you had your true will, you will get a lot of lucky breaks. Yeah. At least that's what, you know, that's the other part of the man doing his true will has the inertia of the universe to assist him. But if it's just, man, I need something very unlikely and lucky to happen, probably not going to happen because you're already misunderstanding the conditions.
Right.
And then I would even say that maybe an example would be to consider what you need the money for and what you're trying to do with it. And then how would you go about getting the money in a mundane sense? And then figuring out on the magical end, what would augment that or what would increase the likelihood of the more mundane things happening that would put money in your pocket, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Or just realize that you don't need money because your true will is to be a bum. That's
abracadabra, I'm a bum. Abracadabra. Bum again.
That joke's only funny to me.
All right. The second requisite of causing any change is that the practical ability to set in right motion the necessary forces. And this is sort of what I'm going to on the bank van metaphor. I'm not saying you couldn't.
Hang on, read the illustration.
Oh, yeah. Illustration. A banker may have a perfect grasp of a given situation, yet lack the quality of decision or the assets necessary to take advantage of it. Where it's like, man, it would be really cool if this armored van had a little uh-oh and dropped the thing of money. But I do not really have the means to be in the right place to take advantage of that, to know where it's going to be, to know what it might screw up to cause the thing. And then even then, it's like, man, I wouldn't even know what to do with it because I'd open it and it'd have one of those little dye packets. And then I look like I'm the Blue Man Group.
You want to hear my incredibly roundabout and stupid thing that this made me think of? Okay, sure. So if you have seen the movie The Shining, you know that there are multiple conspiracy theories about what that movie is actually about online. One of those is that it's about the gold standard. While perusing the internet many years ago, I found someone explaining via an anecdote. They were some writer or director or producer that worked with Kubrick, and they were in an office at the same time, and he had gotten some very bad news about his finances and was bummed out about it. And Kubrick saw him and he's like, what's wrong? And he told him that he had lost a bunch of money. And then Kubrick kind of like knowingly shook his head and told him to invest in gold and told him how well his gold stocks were or his gold bonds were doing. I can't remember how much his gold was worth. I don't know what the terminology is. I forgot. And then the guy sat there feeling bummed out that he didn't have money to invest in gold. And that's what it is. That's what they're talking about. Yeah. Like when you perfectly understand, well, it's like, damn, I lost all this money. And Stanley Kubrick's there telling you like, ah, man, my gold is doing really well. And then but you don't have any practical ability to buy gold.
It'd be like if somebody said, hey, dude, crypto, Bitcoin is about to go through the roof in the next 3 weeks. If you put 10,000 in there, you're going to get, I guarantee you'll get 100,000 back. And you're like, man, I don't even have enough money for spaghetti tonight. Yeah. That's really cool for people who have that money that could do that. But
that's an aspect of magic, having to deal with, I won't even say the material reality, because it's not the material reality that's a problem. It's just the relational context that you have with the world. Sometimes you're not the one that can do the magic to get a bank heist go wrong in front of you.
We'll get off the money thing, for example. Say you did magic to meet some, not even like, oh, I'm going to make this person fall in love with me, because that's skeevy. We've talked about that before. But say it's like, I want to be in the spot where I can meet some girl or some guy or some whatever, to find you a honey. And then like potential honey shows up and you're like, oh man, I forgot that I live with three roommates and I wore my lucky underwear today, but my lucky underwear has no crotch. And
also, I smell bad and I've not showered in 4 days. Damn, I did not think this through.
And you're looking at the salsa stains and the salsa is so hot that it has burned a hole through your gray sweatshirt and you just look like a mess and you're like, shit, I put in motion the opportunity. And I didn't even think through of like, man, I really needed to be in a position to take advantage of this opportunity. And I just wasn't.
Every man and every woman is a star. That is to say, every human being is intrinsically an independent individual with his own proper character and proper motion. Real quick, does your version say that?
It does.
Does it say human being?
Yep.
Okay. Never mind. I'll edit this out then.
He didn't, because I had to edit this one.
And we can go right to the second one after that, where every man and every woman has a course depending partly on the self and partly on the environment, which is natural and necessary for each. Anyone who is forced from his own course, either through not understanding himself or through external opposition, comes into conflict with the order of the universe and suffers accordingly. Illustration. A man may think it's his duty to act a certain way through having made a fancy picture of himself, instead of investigating his actual nature. For example, a woman may make herself miserable for life by thinking that she prefers love to social consideration or vice versa. One woman may stay with an unsympathetic husband when she would really be happy in an addict with a lover, while another may fool herself into a romantic elopement when her only true pleasure are those of presiding at fashionable functions. Again, a boy's instinct may tell him to go to the sea, while his parents insist on his becoming a doctor. In such a case, he will be unsuccessful and unhappy in medicine. A man whose conscious will is at odds with his true will is wasting his strength. He cannot hope to influence his environment efficiently. Illustration, when civil war rages in a nation, it is in no condition to undertake the invasion of other countries. A man with cancer employs his nourishment alike to his own use and to that of the enemy, which is a part of himself. he soon fails to resist the pressures of his environment. In practical life, a man who's doing what his conscience tells him to be wrong will do it very clumsily at first.
Taking all that in, now we get into more particularly Crowley ideas on magic. I'm curious to, because I think what Crowley is implying here is that you can't do magic that goes against your true will, or that you can, but the results of it will be, what I'm trying to parse out here. Do you think that Crowley's saying that if you're doing something that's just against your true will, it won't work because it's just part of the necessary functions that you can't do that? Or do you think he's saying that you can, but it's just going to fuck you
well,
up?
Well, and you know this, is that part of the whole thelemic bag of Crowley is that magic is supposed to be about getting in touch with your true will. You have to make knowledge and conversation of the HGA, and that is what you should be doing. All of your magical acts should be about getting in touch with that before you do anything else.
Right. Because how the hell are you going to know what to do?
That's the idea, I think, is that he is illustrating that you have to know your true will before you do anything. And the reason being that if you don't know what your true will is, you will be at odds with yourself, and therefore you will be at odds with the universe in all you do. So on the level of magic is the art and science of change and conformity with will, so that every intentional act is magical, you won't be able to do a goddamn thing if you are out of sorts with yourself. And we all know this. When you're lost and you're confused and you don't know where you're going in life, you will fuck up everything. you will be stumbling around trying to just get a hold of something, and you will bungle it in every possible way. And then even in the magical sense, if you really don't know what you're about, and that's why we've harped on really knowing yourself, and then also knowing what you really want,
right,
before you try to pick up a wand or do anything weird and out there, because we have desires all of the time, the unceasing desires of, and if you did magic for everything, or even if on the, again, the taking it away from the ritual, ceremonial, or jacking off on a sigil, if you just acted on every single impulse of want, desire, you'd be insane. They'd lock you up.
Yeah, they'd put you in the rubber room at the puzzle factory, as my grandpappy even said.
The puzzle factory. Oh boy.
He was an odd man.
Okay. Yeah, but no, but for real, even outside of a magical sense of it, the idea being that if you don't get yourself in order and you don't really observe what you're about, you will make yourself miserable and unhappy, and you will somehow think that the universe is conspiring against you to keep anything good from happening to you, and you'll have no one else to blame but yourself. Because even in the midst of like all of the shit that is just being in the world's awful sometimes. It's cruel and it's insane and horrible things can happen. But if you're not on your own side, you don't have a fucking prayer.
Yeah.
And I think that is what Crowley is getting at, especially in the concept of like the overarching transcendent will of like the course of your life. Or, you know, Don Juan talked about the path with the heart. You have no choice but to find the path with the heart and just follow it to the end, regardless of what might come of it. It's not so much about being tied to the fruit of it. It is simply finding what you should be doing, you know, what you deep down, what has the meaningful way of being, and following it to its conclusion. In terms of like, oh, well, how do I get big titty goth girlfriend or an armored truck to drop some money? That doesn't really have as much bearing. But perhaps these more flippant or whimsical desires and daydreams might be a product of you being out of sorts with yourself. Sound about right?
Yeah. I don't think I have anything to add to that even.
Oh, and we forgot the last one, because right here is actually where the quote, a man who is doing his true will has the inertia of the universe to assist him.
Illustration. The first principle of success in evolution is that the individual should be true to his own nature and at the same time adapt himself to his environment, which is not really saying much of anything. I mean, let's be honest.
Yeah, that's kind of I won't say huckster, but that's sort of, that's one of those things that sounds kind of profound and deep, but it's like, man, you should have stopped while you were ahead.
Yeah.
I never showed the universe. That's pretty good. I mean, just, you could have caught it. You could have caught it a day there, Al. I'm going on break.
Nature is a continuous phenomenon, but we do not know in all cases how things are connected. Illustration: human consciousness depends on the properties of protoplasm, the existence of which depends on innumerable physical conditions peculiar to this planet, and this planet is determined by the mechanical balance of the whole universe of matter. We may then say that our consciousness is causally connected to the remotest galaxies, yet we do not know even how it arises from or with molecular changes in the brain. Science enables us to take advantage of the continuity of nature by the empirical application of certain principles whose interplay involves different orders of idea connected with each other in a way beyond our present comprehension. Illustration: we are able to know light cities by rule of thumb method. We do not know what consciousness is or how it is connected with muscular action, what electricity is or how it is connected to the machines that generate it, and our methods depend on calculations involving mathematical ideas which have no correspondence in the universe as we know it. Man is ignorant of the nature of his own being and powers. Even his idea of his limitations is based on experience of the past, and every step in his progress extends his empire. There is, therefore, no reason to assign theoretical limits to what he may be or to what he may do. Illustration: two generations ago, it was supposed theoretically impossible that man should ever know the chemical composition of the fixed stars. It is known that our senses are adapted to receive only an infinitesimal fraction of the possible rates of vibration. Modern instruments have enabled us to detect some of these supersensibles by indirect methods, and even to use their peculiar qualities in the service of man, as in the case of the rays of Hertz and Roentgen, respectively radio waves and x-rays, says the note. As Tyndall said, man might at any moment learn to perceive and utilize vibrations of all conceivable and inconceivable kinds. The question of magic is a question of discovering and employing hitherto unknown forces in nature. We know that they exist, and we cannot doubt the possibility of mental or physical instruments capable of bringing us in relation with them. There we go. That is the
big thing that Crowley wants to point out here. This is when we're starting to get into the spooky woo-woo territory, where he's saying, yeah, all right, basically, you as a person are not actually fully aware of what you are, how you are, and how it does.
Or the universe as a whole.
Oh, I can't do this, or this is not possible, are based on past experiences, which in a funny way, it's a bit like saying, oh man, I can't swim. Why? I haven't been able to swim before.
Can I play the piano anymore? Why, of course you can. Well, I couldn't before.
But it's that sort of thing. It's almost the notion of, well, I couldn't do it before. Why should now be any different? Then he makes the point of like, well, we knew for a while that there were
no way you would know what a star was.
Yeah, we once had limited understandings of a great many things, and then science in its infinite progress has made it so that things that you cannot see with the naked eye are not only able to be measured or viewed in some sense, but even employed for our own purposes.
Right.
And then he gets into the idea of like, well, experientially, we all know weird things happen. And there's a whole history of weird things that have happened that fall under this sort of umbrella idea of what magic is and does. And we don't have explanations for them, but at least to a certain extent, we know that they happen. And that's what Crowley is throwing it on, saying like, these things happen. We understand to a certain extent how they happen, yet equipped to point at them in the same way that we might at like infrared or something like that. That doesn't mean anything. And he says magic is the quest of discovering those methods of those hitherto unfound means by which certain actions can be taken.
It's an attitude that I think people in contemporary occultism don't tend to share with Crowley. Crowley, I feel, is very convinced and remained very convinced that magic would be
vindicated by science.
Right. Yeah. That science, and not even in the sense that science would ever be able to fully explain magic, perhaps, but definitely that science would. I think he said something to the effect in an article for Vanity Fair that science was always finding bits
of mysticism. Yeah,
science was always finding bits of mysticism
it had already discovered and making a big deal about how clever it was or something to that effect.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think science for Crowley was very much closer to magic. A lot of people now have a very reactionary sort of stance towards science. Or, well, you know, it's the two poles of it. You're either the person that says, like, magic isn't going to be able to be explained by science because it's not that sort of thing. It's like, those are the, what's the damn Myers-Briggs types? But you
I don't know
what
Myers-Briggs because I don't like pseudoscience. Sorry.
Oh my god. That's awful.
I don't do Myers-Briggs because I don't work at a puzzle factory.
At any rate, people think that magic is more of the like intuitive and emotional and unconscious dealings type of side, and as opposed to science. Whereas I think Crowley is very much on the side of like, yeah, magic is maybe, you know, unexplained by science, but they're doing the same thing. They're working in the same direction.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've said it before. It's like, I don't think that the world would be a better place if everybody got on the train of magic is totally real and super duper serious. I don't think it'd be better if we all threw our dream catchers and our prayer beads into the gutter and said, scientific materialism is the one true answer and everything else is pure, insane unreason. I do think that there's a use in the plurality of views. And on a personal level, I don't go looking around for scientific validation for spooky woo-woo stuff, but the weird things pop up every so often. And then there are more rigorous and experimental takes to magic, and there are more airy-fairy, just doing what feels good approaches to magic. I would say that there's even a benefit to that sort of plurality. Crowley was very much in the camp of like, on a certain level, I am going to be validated at some point.
When they make the industrial semen factories, yes, I'll be vindicated. All right. Every man is more or less aware that his individuality comprises several orders of existence, even when he maintains that his subtler principles are merely symptomatic of the changes in his gross vehicle. A similar order may be assumed to extend throughout nature. Illustration: one does not confuse the pain of toothache with the decay which causes it. Inanimate objects are sensitive to certain physical forces, such as electrical and thermal conductivity, but neither in us nor in them, so far as we know, is there any direct conscious perception of these forces. Imperceptible influences are therefore associated with all material phenomena, and there is no reason why we should not work upon matter through those subtle energies as we do through their material bases. In fact, we use magnetic force to move iron and solar radiation to reproduce images. Man is capable of being and using anything which he perceives, for everything that he perceives is in a certain sense a part of his being. He may thus subjugate the whole universe of which he is conscious to his individual will. Illustration: man has used the idea of God to dictate his personal conduct, to obtain power over his fellows, to excuse his crimes, and for innumerable other purposes, including that of realizing himself as God. He has used the irrational and unreal conceptions of mathematics to help him in the construction of mechanical devices. He has used his moral force to influence the action even of wild animals. He has employed poetic genius for political purposes. Every force in the universe is capable of being transformed into any other kind of force by using suitable means. There is thus an inexhaustible supply of any particular kind of force that we may need. Illustration: heat may be transformed into light and power by using it to drive dynamos. The vibrations of the air may be used to kill men by so ordering them in speech as to inflame warlike passions. The hallucinations connected with the mysterious energies of sex resulted in the perpetuation of the species. The application of any given force affects all the orders of being which exist in the object to which it is applied, whichever of those orders is directly affected. Illustration. If I strike a man with a dagger, his consciousness, not his body only, is affected by my act, although the dagger as such has no direct relation therewith. Similarly, the power of my thought may so work on the mind of another person as to produce far-reaching physical changes in him or her, or in others through him or her.
And finally, a man may learn to use any force so as to serve any purpose by taking advantage of the above theorems. Illustration. A man may use a razor to make himself vigilant over his speech by using it to cut himself whenever he unguardedly utters a chosen word. He may serve the same purpose by resolving that every incident of his life shall remind him of a particular thing, making every impression the starting point of a connected series of thoughts ending in that thing. He might also devote his whole energies to some particular object by resolving to do nothing at variance therewith and to make every act turn to the advantage of that object. Here we get, I won't say quite dancing around it, but not like coming out and saying it either, is the notions of the more subtle spooky woo-woo territory of like talking about the ways that the ephemeral or the ethereal or the things that are not physically real can be made to impact the physical material of things. The effect of my words can do physical damage to somebody.
Yeah, I'm going to say this is the part where I feel like Crowley is tweaking it up, because he went through the whole time being very like, oh, well, you know, magic is just like, say I want to impart some wisdom onto the people. So I summon my spirits of my publisher and I use my magical tools, my ink and pen and paper. He's softballing you these things, just trying to get the concept of like, oh, yeah, it's just like you point your will at stuff and you decide to do things and you do it.
Also, he is giving you the secret.
Oh,
yes. He is telling you, like, these are the ways that you should be framing your will, your objectives, that things you want to happen.
He's trying to give you, like, the ability to have a critical analysis of what you're doing and how to problem solve before he starts giving you reasons to think that, well, you know, maybe the way you think could have physical changes in other people. Or maybe, you know, if you think about it and you feel pain in your tooth, that's not the thing that makes your tooth decay. Something that makes it decay is not really a material thing. Like, you can't grab it and be like, aha, here's the thing that makes my teeth fall out.
And then also, even
unless you're me, and then it's like, you know, it's Skittles. I have a problem. God. He's ratcheting up these ideas where he starts showing you that, like, well, if you after giving you the ability to just have basic problem solving, he starts giving you the unconventional approaches to that unconventional, to that critical
but
problem.
But then he gets a little Alan Moore, although I say that like he didn't exist, you know, 100 years before Alan Moore. But, you know, it's in that Alan Moore vein of like the use of poetry for political purposes, the idea of a speech causing people to die because you inflame warlike passions. It's the notion of these, like I said, these immaterial things that we point to and seeing how they can have effects on very material things, and noticing the degrees of separation between the object targeted or the object of the force and the types of force that can be employed. You know, the example of when I attack somebody with a dagger, it hurts him physically, but it hurts him on a different level of like of his consciousness, his sense of being, you know. And then he goes, well, if that's the case, I mean, then the opposite has to be true, right? Is that the idea of attacking someone's mental apparatus can lead to physical damage.
I think the part where he really jumps the shark into, you know, purely like, okay, now we're talking about like magic.
He says, and then you hit him with a fireball.
But when he says every force in the universe is capable of being transformed into any other kind of force
with the suitable means.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, he gives you the chief example. He's like, oh, well, you know, we can make
heat into light.
The fact that like when he's saying the hallucinations connected with the mystery, the mysterious energies of sex, I'm pretty sure he's talking about like love and infatuation. And he's saying, like, you know,
yeah, yeah. That's, I mean, I'm sure that's what he's getting at. It's like these, the insanity of
Unless I'm doing it wrong.
Insanity that puts you in the puzzle factory called love somehow keeps our species going. Isn't that something? But you also, you'll notice he goes like a scientific, like heat can become light and power. And then it's the vibrations of the air, but it can be used to kill people. But he uses like the subtle thing. Cause it's like speech inflaming people to passion. And then he's like the hallucinations of the mysterious energies of sex turn into like a whole other person. It is almost, I guess this is part of why he talks about the idea of magic being a disease of language. The way he's framing these things, showing the subtleties and the ways of engaging with these things, how something that should not be able to knock an armored truck off the road and put a bag of money at your feet could be used to make that happen.
Yeah. And here's the thing, right? Because a lot of this is basically, a Liber Abba, right?
Sure.
It means something because even now, he's still playing it closer to the chest than he will later in that same work. Yes, no, the forces of your will are represented by the wand. And, oh, here's the, I'm going to talk about the body of light and tell you that you should, like, imagine yourself getting into the consciousness of this body of light that you formed and stuff. You know, he goes full blown, like starts talking about stuff that is undeniably spooky woo-woo. It's just interesting to see that in his entire explanation of magic, he does stay away from virtually anything we can describe as overly metaphysical.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
I mean, like you said, it's something that you can read a lot of this as sort of semantics and linguistics, or even, you know, just metaphor.
Well, I think maybe. I think what it is it's not so much like he's trying to veil it, but it's almost that in the answering of the question, he is trying to, by degrees, bring you into a sense of how you can get from here a very physical, like I employ the spirits of the publishers and booksellers to what magic might mean in the more conventional use of the word. Because you got to remember, this was to a student, and he definitely wasn't employing all of this this song and dance to convince this student that they just needed to be really good at like knowing what mathematics to use to find the hypotenuse. This was somebody that he wanted them to figure out their true will and get their holy guardian angel.
He may attract to himself any force of the universe by making himself a fit receptacle for it, establishing a connection with it, and arranging conditions so that its nature compels it to flow towards him. Illustration. I want pure water to drink. I dig a well in a place where there is underground water. I prevent it from leaking away, and I arrange to take advantage of the water's accordance with the laws of hydrostatics to fill it. Man's sense of himself as separate from and as opposed to the universe is a bar to his conducting its current. It insulates him. Illustration. A popular leader is most successful when he forgets himself and remembers only the cause. Self-seeking engenders jealousies and schism when the organs of the body assert their presence otherwise than by silent satisfaction. It is a sign that they are diseased. The single exception is the organ of reproduction. Yet, even in this case, self-assertion bears witness to its dissatisfaction with itself, since it cannot fulfill its function until completed by its counterpart in another organism. Man can only attract and employ the forces for which he is really fitted. Illustration, you cannot make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. A true man of science learns from every phenomenon, but nature is dumb to the hypocrite, for in her there is nothing false. There is no limit to the extent of the relations of any man with the universe in essence, for as soon as man makes himself one with any idea, the means of measurement cease to exist. But his power to utilize that force is limited by his mental power and capacity, and by the circumstances of his human environment. Illustration. When a man falls in love, the whole world becomes to him nothing but love, boundless and imminent. But his mystical state is not contagious. His fellow men are either amused or annoyed. He can only extend to others the effect which his love has had upon him by means of his mental and physical qualities. Thus, Catullus, Dante, and Swinburne made their love a mighty mover of mankind by virtue of their power to put their thoughts on the subject in musical and eloquent language. Again, Cleopatra and other people in authority molded the fortunes of many other people by allowing love to influence their political actions. The magician, however well he succeeds in making contact with the secret sources of energy and nature, can only use them to the extent permitted by his intellectual and moral qualities. Muhammad's intercourse with Gabriel was only effective because of his statesmanship, soldiership, and the sublimity of his command of Arabic. Hertz's discovery of the rays, which we now use for wireless telegraphy, was sterile until reflected through the minds and wills of the people who could take his truth and transmit it to the world of action by means of mechanical and economic instruments. Going back to the things we were talking about earlier, this is more of the dialing back the ability for you to have.
In theory, you can do all kinds of crazy stuff. There's all these possibilities. In practice, you are limited. And I do think it's worth noting that he does make the point of like using Muhammad and Gabriel, or talking about the being in love, and everybody is like, you see the world as love, 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 and then everybody around you is kind of like, oh man, that's really cute. You're so in love, or God, you are so fucking annoying. But that, so that there is the means, and that often we talk about that with magic, the idea of like, you can steal fire from the heavens, but can you do anything useful with it? You know, a lot of those mystical experiences we harp on are really cool, but are they able to be used for anything in your life? Even if it's like just changing your conduct in life.
Right, yeah.
Very often you'll get like a radical vision or something crazy. It's like, wow, that was so wild. What are you doing with it? I got nothing.
I wrote it down in my journal and then I forgot about it.
Or like even a more cliche example of like, anybody who's ever had those things where you feel like you're going crazy because there's all these wild synchronicities around you and it's like, man, what does it mean though? Why do I keep seeing 23 everywhere?
Right.
I don't know. What am I going to do with it?
It also points to just the thing that we harp on constantly, you know, skills. So much of this is dependent on your ability to take these sort of subtle forces that Crowley is miming at in all these different
and
directions.
Employing them in
use them.
Actually using them in a way that's conducive to what you want. And he uses some very concrete examples of like how these ephemeral and ethereal or non-physical, whatever, these ideas, conceptual things, and saying like, and then here's how people employed them for, you know, getting physical things to happen. But he's still hinting at more spooky, as it were.
Yep. Every individual is essentially sufficient to himself, but he is unsatisfactory to himself until he has established himself in his right relation with the universe. Illustration: a microscope, however perfect, is useless in the hands of savages. A poet, however sublime, must impose himself upon his generation if he is to enjoy and even to understand himself, as theoretically should be the case. Magic is the science of understanding oneself and one's conditions. It is the art of applying that understanding in action. Illustration: a golf club is intended to move a special ball in a special way in special circumstances. A niblick should rarely be used on the tee, or a brassy under the bank of a bunker. Say that five.
Bro, are you
times
talking about
brassy under the bank of a bunker? Brassy under the bank of a bunker. Brassy under the bank of a bunker. Hey, I got it. But also, to the use of any club demands skill and experience. There we go, folks. I should have just waited till we got
talking about that man talking about golf. My brain shut off immediately. What?
Crowley, what's your handicap?
Too easy.
Guarantee you mine's easy. Every man has an indefensible right to be what he is. Illustration: to insist that anyone else shall comply with one's own standards is to outrage not only him, but oneself, since both parties are equally born of necessity.
In a weird way, that points at the thing I was talking about, the benefit of the plurality of views, you know, but that really gets to the idea of like, everyone is what they are. Every man is a star. Every star has a course, that sort of thing. I don't have as much to say about that. This also, the earlier lines get to the same thing he's talking about, where it's when you understand yourself in a bigger picture, you will know how to take these conceptual and subtle things and make them into real action.
Right. Well, and I think ideally he's saying that if you understand your place in the world, you're going to understand all of these forces very easily anyway, right?
And like, you'll understand everyone else too.
Right. Yeah. And it harps on Crowley's big magical philosophical ideas, right? Crowley wants you to discover your true will and figure out what you're really about and get all that. And then all of this magic shit will be secondary to that. And I think Crowley, in a lesser or greater extent, thinks that the necessity of the magic, quote unquote, stuff is secondary to figuring out who the hell you are. Because I'm sure there's plenty of people in his mind whose true will had nothing to do with magic and they accomplished it amazingly. Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. That's part of why he employs that very general idea of art and science change in conformity with will. Because in his mind, it's like there are people that are doing really good magic that don't do any spooky woo-woo nonsense. It's like they know what their will is. They know how to employ the proper forces, and they make things happen.
Every man must do magic each time he acts or even thinks, since a thought is an internal act whose influence ultimately affects action, though it may not do so at the time. Illustration: the least gesture causes a change in a man's own body and in the air around him. It disturbs the balance of the entire universe, and its effects continue eternally throughout all space. Every thought, however, swiftly suppressed, has its effect on the mind. It stands as one of the causes of every subsequent thought and tends to influence every subsequent action. A golfer may lose a few yards on his drive, a few more with his second and third. He may lie on the green 6 bare inches too far from the hole, but the net result of these trifling mishaps is the difference of a whole stroke, and so probably between having and losing.
And he's talking about golf again. Boo.
Yeah, just give it up.
Boo this man. Man, I thought Crowley was cool until he started talking about golf, man. Shit.
So we're
done. All right. But you know what? We're gonna do golf rules. 3 strikes and he's out. Oh, he mentions golf one more time, then he's going in the penalty box.
But do you have anything to say on this? This idea that every act is magic and you have to do magic when you're
This idea gets employed in the Jungian sense too, where it talks about the inner work that you're going to do regardless, you know, so you better do it intelligently.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I think that Crowley is setting up the idea of every intentional act of will is a magical act, and therefore every thought is a magical act, and that everything is, I won't say necessarily a continuous act, but every act is contingent on everything that's come before it. I guess in that regard, because he's setting up the idea of everyone has the right to be what they are. Every thought and action that they do is part of that course of what they are. You know, that is the orbit of the star. So it would behoove you to have a good understanding of what you're about and what your course is. And this is going to the sort of philosophical underpinnings and to a certain extent, I guess, the psychological underpinnings of a very thelemic point of view. I don't necessarily have much to say about this in light of like chaos magic, I guess, but and not so much in the regards of like direct application of like spooky woo-woo stuff.
No, yeah, I think this is getting more into Crowley's general ideas because, again, his philosophy.
But it is hammering home that idea of like know thyself and know, you know, get your true will and set that in order and then just go with it.
Yeah, and we're still rolling with this. So every man has a right, the right of self-preservation, to fulfill himself to the utmost. Illustration: a function imperfectly performed injures not only itself, but everything associated with. If the heart is afraid to beat for fear of disturbing the liver is starved for blood and avenges itself on the heart by upsetting digestion, which disorders respiration, on which cardiac welfare depends. Every man should make magic the keynote of his life. He should learn its laws and live by them. Let's just stop there because that's like...
Well, yeah, that is getting to what we're talking about. One of the good applications of the art and science change in conformity of will is that if you do view every act as a magical act, everything is about change in conformity of will, then you should learn the laws and live by them But that means that your whole life is a continuous or ongoing magical act. We are all our own great work, that sort of thing. And that is that that really is the capstone of what he's trying to get at. If you don't do it with all you've got, if you don't go all the way, you're going to screw yourself up. So you better understand exactly what you're about, how you're going to go about doing it, and understanding what happens when you know, if you're going to employ a force, where to employ it, how to employ it, and what to employ it on. And your whole life should be viewed with that sort of scrutiny. At least that's what Crowley is recommending.
Right. Illustration. The banker should discover the real meaning of his existence, the real motive which led him to choose that profession. He should understand banking as a necessary factor in the economic existence of mankind, instead of as merely a business whose objects are independent of the general welfare. He should learn to distinguish false values from real and to act not on accidental fluctuations, but on considerations of essential importance. Such a banker will prove himself superior to others because he will not be an individual limited by transitory things, but a force of nature, as impersonal, impartial, and eternal as gravitation, as patient and irresistible as the tides. His system will not be subject to panic any more than the law of inverse squares is disturbed by elections. He will not be anxious about his affairs because they will not be his, and for that reason, he will be able to direct them with the calm, clear-headed confidence of an onlooker, with intelligence unclouded by self-interest and power unimpaired by passion. Which, again, I think points to like the bigger ideas of what Crowley is about and why that may not be something that works for you in the contemporary chaos magic world at all. Talks about this in the Book of Thoth too, I think, where he's discussing the issue of divination being that once you're
really good at it,
the time that you're most equipped to be able to do it is when you no longer need it.
Yeah. But that's also, I think he would say that a lot about like any of the spooky woo-woo ritual stuff, you know, any of the wand waving, crystal gazing. It's like, if you're really following the path and you've got your true will locked down and you really know what you're about and you act without acting and everything gets done, then you're not really going to need a lot of these things. It's almost the catch-22. It's like, oh man, I'm thinking about the thing he talked about where the person who dedicated himself to learning to walk on water and he finally gets across and then seeing everybody taking the boat.
Yeah, that's nonsense.
If all he was worried, if the goal was really just to get across the water, he could have done it. Instead, he wasted a lot of energy trying to do something wild.
Right, right. Here, we're almost at the end. Every man has a right to fulfill his own will without being afraid that it may interfere with that of others. For if he is in his proper path, it is the fault of others if they interfere with him. If a man like Napoleon were actually appointed by destiny to control Europe, he should not be blamed for exercising his rights. To oppose him would be an error. Anyone doing so would have made a mistake as to his own destiny, except insofar as it might be necessary for him to learn the lesson of defeat. The sun moves in space without interference. The order of nature provides an orbit for each star. A clash proves that one or the other has strayed from its course. But as to each man that keeps true his course, the more firmly he acts, the less likely are others to get in his way. His example will help them to find their own paths and pursue them. Every man that becomes a magician helps others to do likewise. The more firmly and surely men move, and the more such action is accepted as the standard of morality,
the less will conflict and confusion hamper humanity.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, and that's,
I feel like Crowley got off track and stopped explaining what magic was and started explaining what you should be doing with magic.
Well, it's not necessary. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing because he covered a lot of what we were getting at, and he does wrap it up right in the last section right after this too. But he is really illustrating the philosophical worldview of Thelema. Now, I do also wonder about the idea of conflict and confusion. I mean, there is the argument that those things are necessary. You know, he even talks about like insofar as one, it might be necessary for one to learn the lesson of defeat. You know, perhaps what one might view as orbits coming into conflict or or in their course, it might be that those things are just necessary parts of the courses themselves, you know?
Right.
Nobody likes to hear the idea that maybe things like war and conflict and horrible things happening might just be necessary to the course of the universe. It's unpleasant, definitely, but the Buddhists really got a hang of it. They understand that, like, oh yeah, it's all kind of fucked, ain't it?
Well, in a certain sense, Marx did as well, if that's what you're going
with. But I do think that Crowley, maybe Crowley does have the idea that's like, well, if everybody just had their true will, it would be utopia. Nobody would conflict with anyone because we would all just be doing our thing. But maybe, you know, it's also strange that, like, you read the book of the third chapter of the Book of the Law, at least, and it's talking about, like, nah, get a war. I'll give you a war engine. Go crush your enemies. See them driven before you. Hear the lamentations of the women.
There's a lot to unpack in that whole thing, and I don't think we have time to go into the Crowley's particular views on, like, violence and conquest, or what a thelemic view of those sorts of things, or even just conflict and competition in general, maybe.
But he does, if you do go with the adage of, like, the man doing his true will has the inertia of the universe to assist them, it does kind of make sense to the idea of, like, well, if you're doing what you're supposed to, you'll succeed. You will come out on top. Even if things aren't necessarily going like perfectly well, you will be able to maintain and just do what you're doing.
Well, I mean, I think he kind of flat out says something, you know, in there that we can take as him implying that if you're doing your true will, even when people get in your way, it's not going to be much of a hindrance to you. What was that line?
Well, he does say the, you know, clear-headed confidence of an onlooker with the intelligence unclouded by self-interest and power unimpaired by passion. That very much sounds like the, even if things aren't going perfectly well, you're able to be apart from it and keep on your course.
Right, yeah.
And props to him. He didn't mention golf again. That's what we call a layup.
Oh, my God. Well, Can I do the end? Yes,
end?
please.
Well, here endeth the first lesson. No, sorry, I'll stop. Well, here endeth the first lesson. That seems to me to cover the ground fairly well. At least that is what I have to say when serious analysis is on the agenda. But there is a restricted and conventional sense in which the word may be used without straying too far from the above philosophical position. One might say, magic is the study and use of those forms of energy which are A, subtler than the ordinary physical mechanical types, B, accessible only to those who are, in one sense or another, initiates. I fear that this may sound rather obscurum per obscurus, but this is one of these cases. We are likely to encounter many such in the course of our researches in which we understand quite well enough for all practical purposes what we mean, but which elude us more and more successfully the more accurately we struggle to define their import. We might fare even worse if we tried to clear things up by making lists of events in history, tradition, or experience and classifying these as being and those as not being true magic. The borderland cases would confuse and mislead us. But since I have mentioned history, I think it might help if I went straight to the latter part of your question and gave you a brief sketch of magic, past, present, and future as it is seen from the inside. What are the principles of the masters? What are they trying to do? What have they done in the past? What means do they employ? As it happens, I have by me a sketch written by M. Gerald Amont of Tooney some 20 years ago, which covers the subject with reasonable adequacy. I have been at the pains of translating it from his French. I hope not too much reminiscent of the old... Fuck, dude, I didn't realize it was going to be French. God damn it.
Trattatore. Oh my God.
That probably means golf and golfer. I will revise it. Divide it, like gall, into three parts and send it along. Love is the law, love under will. Oh man, that part didn't even have anything to do with this.
The essay on the three schools of magic is reproduced as letters 6, 7, and 8.
Damn it. I forgot that was her. Also, Gerald Amott was a journalist who translated the Book of the Law into French. That's kind of neat. That's a little footnote at the end.
Oh, yeah. There was a big argument about whether or not that was just a Crowley pseudonym.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's kind of funny. There we go. When I talked about the too long didn't read, you know, magic is the study and use of those forms of energy which are subtler than ordinary physical mechanical types, accessible only to those who are in one sense or another initiates, blah, blah, blah. And then he even says that it's like, it's weird that we kind of know magic, like when we're talking about it in conventional talk. And then when we try to pin down a really concrete definition, we end up giving ourselves problems.
I mean, I'm not going to talk about Wittgenstein on this, but it's Wittgenstein language games. Go look it up. You'll figure it out. Overall, what do we think of Crowley's explanation of magic? Maybe even stepping outside of Thelema itself necessarily, but about what he said about magic. Because here's the thing. I think his second definition of magic is very underrated, and we should start convincing people to use that instead of the change in conformity with will one.
I think that it is I'm going to agree with you there. I think that is a very effective definition that kind of gets to the heart of the weird stuff when we talk about magic. But if you are going to be one of those people that says any intentional act is a magical act, you should really be familiar with this particular chapter, because when people say, like, follow up with you on that, you need to be able to talk about the rest of the story. You know, tell them about the theorems and the postulates.
Right. And if you don't actually agree with Crowley's reasoning,
tell them you're not conforming to the postulate.
You're not conforming to the postulate. Get on the ground.
when somebody says, why didn't my magic work? I'm going to go, you didn't conform to the postulate.
No, but seriously, because it was reused by Carroll, because it's a bit of a meme in and of itself, and because people don't read Crowley closely enough anymore, people need to be aware of this chapter so they know if they actually agree with that statement or not. If they think that what they're saying and what Crowley's saying are the same, or if they mean something else entirely by art and science, because I've seen people straight up use that definition and then talk to me about science as like applied practicalness and art as like a poetic sort of self-creation type thing. And I'm like, well, that's not what Crowley meant when he said it.
I could see maybe even if you had read Crowley, like if you had read this, I could see where maybe you might've gotten that, but I don't think that's what he meant, you know. But yeah, I think that this is a really useful chapter. I mean, I know we say a lot, we're not like the podcast that's going to teach you magic. We're not the ones that like are coming in saying, hey, here's how you get started with magic, or we're not a beginner's thing for anybody. We're not really in the realm of teaching. I think I hit it on the head when I said, like, what our goal is to entertain you and maybe inspire you to go do some magic on your own, or you know, that neglected practice that you had that you're looking around to try to get ideas. And maybe we'll tell you something that will motivate you to get out of the armchair and go do something. But we're not in the business of looking for like acolytes or disciples. We're looking for patrons.
Yeah.
We're looking for $5.
We're looking for people to pay us to be goofy little dudes, be chill guys.
Goofy guy. Magic is the art and science of being a goofy little guy so that someone will give you $5. But if you were, or hell, even if you're an experienced practitioner, this is something that maybe you should read again and really turn around in your noggin. Although you just heard us read it, so like you kind of have.
Yeah, you're not going to be surprised by it. There's not a twist ending if you read it yourself.
No, you're going to read it and find the secret third golf reference.
All right. I guess we're going to call that one good.
Yeah, I think I've said about all I can say on the matter.
Well, cool. In that case, everyone, thank you for listening. We will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, guys. Co-host again. Wasn't that the single greatest thing you've ever heard? Seriously, folks, thank you for listening, and if you liked what you heard, you can find more of these bonus episodes on the Chaos Magic News Patreon. For as little as $5 a month, you can support the objectively best occult podcast on the net. If you'd like to get in touch with us or see some goofy memes, we're all over social media, and we have a Discord where you can yell at us directly. and you can find all of those under Chaos Magic News. We hope to hear from you soon, so bye, guys.
Mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell.